Elizabeth Barrett is a wife, mother, grandmother, licensed marriage and family therapist, educator, eavesdropper, and emotion worker. She uses all of these skills to address the subjects that we all grapple with in this conversation with the reluctant therapist. Happy Healthy Tuesday, Elizabeth.
Happy Healthy Tuesday, Francisco.
Good to see you. Where are we going today?
Well, today's one of my favorite days because I have the honor of having one of my idols on the show with me for not the first time or second time, but actually the third time, which makes me feel very special and excited. And I'm excited to introduce you to Rhianne Eisler, Francisco, because I think you will know her work, but not really know it comes from her, because you're hearing a lot of the work that she's done over the last 30 years coming to the surface in a lot of political campaigns and the new platforms of the Democratic Party and the Green parties and kind of this whole forward momentum into the 21st century, moving from a domination-based cultural narrative to a partnership-based cultural narrative, one that supports those who do the caregiving work in society, coming from a place of empathy, having more support, financial support for education and childcare and for those that are caring for the elderly and the sick. So you may not know Dr. Eisler personally or through, you know, your experience as a young person, but you're going to recognize all of the contributions she's made to our society. And so, gosh, in 1990, when I started graduate school, one of the first books they had us read was The Chalice and the Blade. And it lifted me in a direction that I was not going in any way, shape, or form. It really shaped how I looked at our culture, the history of how we came together as civilizations, the power of the goddess culture and women in society. And I had grown up, I was 30 at the time, and for 30 years, I had really kind of lived that narrative of women being the second class to men in society, a lot of shame and loathing about bodies and pleasure. And all of a sudden I read this book and it opened up all of the directions that I've been heading for the last 30 plus years. And so I have Dr. Eisler to thank for that. And then along the way, as part of Dr. Eisler's work, after writing The Chalice and the Blade, there was so much, there was so many people calling for a plan for how do we implement this new way of seeing culture, that in 1987, she founded the Center for Partnership Studies. And that's where we're going to kind of focus our energy today, in how that the center has grown and changed and now is really directly influencing the direction of our culture politically, socially, environmentally, and hopefully the actual narrative of how we choose to live our lives. So I don't want to spend a lot of time kind of introducing the show. I want to jump into my conversation. So I'm just going to say that I am Elizabeth Barrett, and this is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. And although we can't take phone calls directly, you can call in with questions or comments. Our number is 805-549-8855. Francisco will be happy to read your question or comment over the air. So it's 805-549-8855. You can send us an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. You can follow us on Instagram, follow us on Facebook to find out what's happening or see pictures or leave comments or questions also on those two fronts. And you can listen to previous shows by visiting kcbx.org or podcasting our show, and then you can listen at your convenience. Or if you'd like to share my conversation with Rhianne, which I think you will want to, you can podcast the show, send a link to friends, and grow our community. So I'm excited to see where our conversation takes us today. We're going to take a quick break and jump back in for my conversation with Dr. Rhianne Eisler. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
How many people had to survive so you could arrive? How many people had to survive so you could arrive? How many people had to survive so you could arrive? How many people had to survive?
I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. And I would like to welcome to the show this week Dr. Rion Eisler, author, social systems scientist, thought leader, progressive knowledge leader. I don't even know how many directions to go because I want to read your entire resume, but that would take half of our conversation. But your latest work is Nurturing Our Humanity, How Domination and Partnership Shape Our Brains, Lives, and Future. You are also the founder, Rion is also the founder of the Center for Partnership Studies, which was founded in 1987. She's authored many articles, many other books, including Sacred Pleasure, other partnership books. She has spoken to the UN and to Congress about her work with the Center for Partnership Studies. And so I'm just excited and honored to have you back on the show with me today, Rion.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Elizabeth.
I wish we could do it in person, but I've been saying that a lot lately. I miss getting to sit face to face and have a conversation.
Well, it's good to be able to do it electronically.
That's true. I let a little progress towards the future. So let's, you know, you're so busy in so many different areas, and I wanted to focus on kind of what had been coming up a lot over the last year and a half during the election cycle. I kept thinking about you every time I heard one of the candidates speak, because all of a sudden we start hearing a lot more about funding for childcare, more funding to support, you know, working families, more money put into education, more money put into supporting the work of caregivers. And all I kept thinking was, Rion has somehow gotten her message through. We're starting to actually see or hear these policies that you've been talking about coming to the forefront. So how did this feel to get your platforms pushed forward, and what did it take to get here?
Well, I've been ahead of my time, because so many of these policies and directions are really part of the chalice and the blade already, you know, which came out in 1987 and is now in its 57th U.S. printing with a new epilogue. So if people get it, they should really get the 56th or 57th printing, because the epilogue takes it up to date, up to the Trump times. But it feels like there's some grounded hope that we have made some progress, even during the last 4 years of massive regression, really. And I think that the COVID-19 pandemic has really shown the lack of resilience, the lack of justice, the really lack of ability to address our most pressing social, economic, and environmental problems. Yes, I wish it had come to the fore earlier, but I am delighted to see, for example, that President Biden is launching a campaign to invest in human infrastructure. You know, that's a term that I introduced really in my book, The Real Wealth of Nations, which came out in 2007. And that book also introduced the concept of what I called a caring economics of partnerism. And at that time, just putting caring and economics in the same sentence, my gosh, it was like, what? And today, the term got co-opted to only mean the care economy. But that's okay. It's a start. Because by caring economy, of course, I meant an economic system that is informed by these values of caring for people starting at birth, and caring for our natural life support systems.
So let's back up just a little then for people who might not be familiar with your work. And you wrote The Chalice and the Blade. Was that, when you wrote The Chalice and the Blade, were you writing that from a social systems scientist perspective, or from your perspective as a lawyer, or from your perspective as a woman, or what was it that kind of drove you to even dive into this story of the lost partnership civilizations?
Well, I would say, yeah, I wrote it from all of these perspectives, Elizabeth. And as you also know, and as readers of my work know, the passion that I have for this work really was to, yes, it is a multidisciplinary, transdisciplinary systems analysis in the true sense of the word, because so many of the studies of society, as do our social categories, they marginalize or ignore the majority of humanity, women and children. And you can't possibly understand a social system if you leave out the majority of humanity, including where we all live in our families, which is given short shrift. And my latest book that you just mentioned, Nurturing Our Humanity, documents what we today know from study after study of neuroscience of how important the first 5 years of life are, and how these are directly influenced by whether a culture or subculture, you know, as mediated through families, education, religion, etc., orients to the partnership or domination side of the social scale I introduced. But the questions from my childhood, to answer your question, were, does it really have to be this way? Because as a child refugee with my parents from Nazi Europe, I really had to ask whether there has to be so much cruelty, insensitivity, and violence, whether it's really inevitable, as we're often told, you know, whether it's original sin or selfish genes, it's the same story. We're bad. We have to be rigidly controlled from the top. And my answer from my research, which, of course, I undertook many, many years later, was a resounding, it does not have to be this way. And in fact, excuse me, as you mentioned, for millennia, we know now from archaeology, anthropology, linguistics, DNA studies, for millennia, we oriented more to the partnership side of the social scale, more equitable, yes, gender balanced, and far less violent societies.
So as I'm jumping a little bit back and forth, because I think it's all connected, but jumping a little from 1987 to 2021, because it's just been kind of this wave of movement that you've been a part of. But here we are in 2021, and we're hearing a lot of conversations about systems and needing to break down systems and recalibrate every institution that our whole culture is based on, from the prison industrial complex to our educational institutions, you know, to all the ways that we actually operate as human beings, because it's not good enough to change individual policies, but we have to change the thought that went in, or the who is benefiting from the way the systems were put together. Even in the field of psychology, my world, the whole idea that psychology itself was based on this idea of white supremacy and male domination. And so even doing this work as a woman, the foundation of my field is challenging. And so it's remarkable to me that you brought all this together in The Chalice and the Blade, and then, you know, have been able to have this vision since 1987, that wasn't enough just to have the equal rights movement, or the ERA, or the civil rights movement, that it was actually something deeper. Can you talk about that? That it wasn't just a matter of granting people more rights, but going after the actual foundation of the story.
Well, I think that there's so much to say about all of this, but we can shortcut some of it by really revisiting the last 300 years of modern history, which are presented in our history books like this random series of events. Mm-hmm. But actually what we see writ large is one progressive social movement after another, each challenging the same thing, a tradition of domination. Mm-hmm. Whether it was challenging in the 1700s, 1800s, the so-called divinely ordained right of kings to rule, or the feminist and later women's rights movement, challenging again the so-called divinely ordained right of men to rule over women and children, or the again so-called divinely ordained right of a quote superior race to rule over a quote inferior one, all the way to the environmental movement, mm-hmm. challenging our once hallowed conquest and domination of nature, which at our level of technological development could do us in, mm-hmm. as we're seeing with climate change, etc., not to speak of the weaponry we today have at this level of technology. So if we understand this, we see, I mean, sometimes I say it as a joke that when I get really depressed, I think of the European Middle Ages. Why? Because they looked a lot like, well, like the Taliban. The domination configuration, you know, top-down rule in theocratic, as a matter of fact, in both the family and the state or tribe. Rigid male dominance. Think of the witch burnings, for example. I mean, it was horrendous. Or the Inquisition and violence and abuse. That was it. And stories and language that reinforced this. And so we have moved, but, and this is really fundamental to my analysis, most of these movements have focused on trying to dismantle what I call the top of the domination pyramid, mm-hmm. politics and economics as conventionally defined, and they've left in place the foundations, childhood, neuroscience is very clear on that, gender, fundamental because we have a hidden system of gendered values. There's always been enough money for the stereotypically masculine, nothing to do with men really, but, you know, domination, punishment, you know, I mean, prisons, punitive male head of household, what is that? Or weapons and wars, but somehow there hasn't been enough money for the soft, for the stereotypically feminine, caring for children, caring for people's health, caring for our natural life support system. And what we're seeing is movement in the partnership direction accelerated now, but also enormous resistance. And as we saw, regression.
Right. For every few steps forward, there's a price that is paid for those that are progressing by a regression backwards, almost punishment for trying to be heard. And as you were talking, I was thinking, and I know this isn't new to you, but it just occurred to me, you said moving out of the Middle Ages or moving out of the kingdoms of Europe was the founding fathers coming to the United States with this idea of moving to freedom, religious freedom, or the freedom to express themselves and not be ruled or dominated. But the system they set up still dominated over half of, they just became dominators themselves.
Well, so, of course, I mean, but you have to think of the fact that they did not address the foundations.
Right.
And I'm not only speaking of slavery, but I mean, when they were talking about freedom and equality and pursuit of happiness, they were talking of free white men. Right. Women could not even vote. Women at that time, and I really go into that in my analysis of why we have to leave behind this stupid argument between capitalism and socialism. Because I mean, if one thing the pandemic showed is we need both businesses, markets, and government policies, the question is what kinds do we have? But, you know, women we're supposed to do the work of caring, caregiving, for free in and keeping a clean and healthy environment, which translates, of course, into our planetary environment, for free in a male-controlled household. And even as late as when Marx wrote, in many places, a woman could not even sue for injuries negligently inflicted on her. Only her husband could for loss of her services. We really have to know our history. And yes, I mean, you asked me about being my legal background. It helps because laws can be instruments of changing norms or of maintaining norms. And that law was a way of really maintaining the norm of male dominance. And right, with it, the devaluation of anything, quote, soft, feminine.
Because even when women earned the right to vote with the 19th Amendment, that head of household laws were still in place. And so women were still dominated by their husbands as to even how they were going to vote into the late 50s.
Right.
So there's kind of, it seems like we get thrown these veils of change or the stories that things are changing that are just surface because the foundations themselves never change. If you're just tuning in, this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and I'm honored today to have as my guest Dr. Rian Eisler, author, social systems scientist, thought leader, one of the 20 most influential thinkers of the 20th century, if I recall, author of The Chalice and the Blade, and her most recent work, which is really coming to the forefront in our social conversations, is Nurturing Our Humanity, How Domination and Partnership Shape Our Brains, Lives, and Future. And you can ask a question, if you'd like, by giving us a call at 805-549-8855. So, Rian, so let's assume that everybody gets the story now, that although women and different groups feel like they've made steps forward over the last 30, 40, 50 years, there's always the regression backwards, the punishment, laws that get changed. You know, we see the voting rights laws being changed in Georgia. We see transgender protections under the law being reversed. We see reproductive rights. Like, we're seeing the regressions. And yet, your work for the center, you know, founding the Center Partnership Studies, has put together a 21st century political agenda that I'd kind of like to break down each of the cornerstones so that people can really understand what it is we're talking about when you describe a shift from domination to partnership. Does that work for you?
Absolutely.
Okay. So what I have from your work, and if people are interested, you can go to the Center for Partnership Studies website. It's laid out beautifully, all the cornerstones, Rian's work, access to articles. But here's the four cornerstones of the 21st century political agenda, which will nurture our humanity and protect our planet by rebuilding, number one, childhood and family. So how does that look?
Well, let me back up a little bit.
Please do.
And really remind us that, well, something that I realized was something of a shock, that in all my years of so-called higher education, there had been hardly anything about people like me, women. I, about four, but also hardly anything about children, except in an occasional course on child psychology or something like that. And even now, it's an occasional course on psychology, on neuroscience, a child development, rather than being integrated into the entire curriculum, including sociology, political science, economics. Mm-hmm. Because what do we know today from neuroscience, which is one of the themes in my book, Nurturing Our Humanity, which, by the way, I'm going to take a little side trip for a second. Okay. I had been working on that book for 7 years. It takes me a long time to get the research for my books. And then I invited the anthropologist Douglas Fry to be my co-author. And one of the reasons was that he is one of the world's authorities on how we humans lived for millennia, millions of years, in foraging societies. And he calls them the original partnership societies. They were more gender balanced, more egalitarian, far less violent. In fact, we know today that warfare, which we're told is human nature, right? You know, caveman cartoon, you know, the club, the weapon, the woman dragging by the hair, you know, it's a domination system. Nonsense. Warfare is only 5 to 10,000 years old, which is a drop, a tiny drop in the evolutionary bucket. So we have to change our stories. But to get back to really childhood, what we know today from neuroscience is that this whole argument of nature versus nurture, it's a non-issue. It fragments our consciousness, really. The issue is the interaction of our biology with our environment, and that are nothing less than how the architecture of our brains is developed in that interaction, and it's very different depending on the degree of orientation of a culture, whether it's rightist, leftist, religious, secular, Eastern, Western, Northern, Southern, you know, capitalist, socialist, to either end of this partnership domination social scale. So the fact that we're talking today, that the American Psychological Association, for example, has come out, as you know, Elizabeth, finally, in saying, hey, spanking is not only ineffective as a means of socialization, but it is harmful both physically and psychologically. But it didn't go deep enough. Because what do children learn? Really, they learn that it's okay for those who are bigger and stronger to use violence against those who are less able to defend yourselves, even little children who are dependent on grown-ups for life. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I could go on and on, but you can read all about it in Nurturing Our Humanity. So this cornerstone has been ignored in our sociology classes. Yes, psychology has talked a lot about it, but only about families. Well, families don't arise in a vacuum. They're part of a larger culture, just as economics, politics, etc. are.
Right. So that first cornerstone, if I'm understanding, is actually just starting a re-education of how we do everything by changing the way we parent our children in a nonviolent, more empathic, more democratic, letting children observe and witness more egalitarian partnerships in the marriage and the family. And so when a child ostensibly grows up in a family system that is partnership based and full of empathy and valuing the caregiving and the caring, then they translate that into their adult lives. Like, that's kind of the starting
point. That is really the starting point. And it's an enormously important one. And I really want to make a distinction here. In the 60s, we thought that the opposite, you know, of this authoritarian, punitive style of parenting that's characteristic of domination systems, you know, whether it was Hitler's Germany, a secular Western society, or Stalin's Soviet Union, again, a leftist secular society, or Khomeini's Iran, or the Taliban, it doesn't really matter, or the rightist fundamentalist alliance. We thought that we should just be very, quote, permissive, laissez-faire. And that's rebellion, mistaking rebellion for reconstruction. Today, we're talking about authoritative rather than authoritarian, and certainly nonviolent. And there's a wonderful caring and connected parenting guide that you can get for free in either English or Spanish at centerforpartnership.org. That's a good start.
That is a good start, because how we change the narrative for the next generation of children, my grandchildren, could change the whole course of our society, which I think is the good news. Maybe this generation that's coming up right now, the Gen Zs and even the millennials, they have been raised in structures that are more egalitarian than many, many decades before them. And so I'm seeing that in my classes and seeing that, you know, in the people that I work with, that they're already, they resonate with these platforms of egalitarian policies and more childcare. And so it's almost like your work has already quietly been happening in the parenting of the last couple of decades, but now it's hitting the spotlight.
And the two things are completely interconnected. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is why this should be part of sociology, political science, economics, this understanding. But we cannot connect the dots, for one thing, in a very siloed educational system. But for another, if that system either marginalizes or ignores the majority of humanity, I mean, forget it. And yet, as you say, Elizabeth, it's beginning gradually to change. But institutions change very slowly. I mean, there are just a very few institutions that are multidisciplinary, interdisciplinary, transdisciplinary. And yet there's such a yearning for that on the part of young people. They want to connect the dots.
Well, because I think, like you, when you were young, many, many more of them are starting to say, or have been saying, it does it have to be like this? And they're starting to realize, like you did many, many years ago, it doesn't. My guest today is Dr. Rian Eisler, author, social systems scientist, thought leader. Her latest work is Nurturing Our Humanity, How Domination and Partnership Shape Our Brains, Lives, and Future. And we're talking about her 21st century political agenda, which has been making its way to the forefront over the last couple election cycles. And we're going to take a quick break, but we're going to come back and continue talking about those four cornerstones of society and how we rebuild and change narratives so that we can have a more just and equitable future moving forward. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
Rose and flows of angel hair, and ice cream castles in the air, and feather canyons everywhere. Looked at clouds that way, but now they only block the sun. They rain and they snow on everyone. So many things I would have done.
You're listening to A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist here on KCBX. If you have any questions for our guests today, you can call them in. Our phone number is 800-549-8855. Let's continue on with this conversation. Elizabeth, back to you.
Thank you, Francisco. All right, Rian, so we touched briefly on the first cornerstone of family and childhood, and I'm just going to list all four cornerstones if people are keeping track. So the 21st century political agenda that grew from the Center for Partnership Studies, founded by Dr. Eisler in 1987, in a response to her groundbreaking work in The Chalice and the Blade that was written in 1987. It is all coming together in 2021 with this political agenda, and the four cornerstones for change in our society are family and childhood. The second one is gender. The third one is economics. And then the fourth cornerstone is the stories and narratives that we tell. And so we touched a bit on childhood and how we have to educate people as to how to best raise children to live in an egalitarian partnership-based society. And I just wanted to side note to you, because, you know, I teach family psychology, and it's been really sad for me over the course of the 10 years I've been teaching it, that my class has become pushed further and further out of the curriculum as not being valued and an essential part of what students need. And yet the feedback I get from students is, I wish this was a GE. I wish every student could take it because I talk specifically about the things that you teach, you know, how parenting and choosing a mate and going, you know, through our life cycle. So it hurts my heart to hear you saying we need to have this when I see in my own experience how we continue to devalue this education for young people coming up today. Because we don't have economics classes or home economics classes anymore. We don't have any parenting classes. So where do we think people are going to learn these skills?
Well, we've got to have these things and we've got to mobilize. That's a military word, I guess. We have to work together in order to really see to it that our educational system teaches, as you said, the skills, because it is skills we're talking about. And remember what Gandhi said. He said, let's not confuse the habitual for the inevitable or normal, but we have to be taught that. Mm-hmm. So I really urge our listeners, wherever you are, you can be an agent of change in the partnership direction. And don't get discouraged because it's really putting those four cornerstones, shifting them from domination to partnership, that are going to give us the foundations to prevent these periodic regressions. What you're describing is part of a regression, Elizabeth. Mm-hmm. The narrowing of what is taught under the guise of, well, that's necessary for the post-industrial age. Actually, we know from neuroscience, and I'm jumping now to the third cornerstone, but it's okay, that, you know, it's not only a question of human well-being or environmental sustainability, but of economic success in the post-industrial age, when economists keep telling us that our most important capital, I hate that word, I mean, the human infrastructure now we're talking about, is our human infrastructure. And we know from neuroscience that whether or not we have these resilient, creative people who can work in teams rather than just taking orders, etc., largely hinges on the quality of care and education children receive in the first 5 years of life. Now, we know this from neuroscience. Let us change our policies. And I really give a lot of credit to the Biden administration, even though, as I said, the term caring economics, they co-opted it. Well, it got co-opted. It wasn't by them to just mean the care economy. But now talking about the human infrastructure is like taking a leaf out of my work, really. But it isn't a question of my work. It is the reality mm-hmm. of what we need. And that takes me right back to gender.
Okay.
Because why haven't we had really an economic system, be it capitalist or socialist, that really focuses on our human infrastructure and our natural infrastructure? And it is because we've had this gendered system of values, which I mentioned earlier, in which anything stereotypically now associated with women and the so-called feminine, whether in women or men, or in social and economic policy, is devalued. It's almost invisible, just like the so-called women's work was before it, part of it at least, got transferred into the formal monetary economy. But then notice, for very low wages. And yet we know from studies, like a fairly recent Australian studies, that if the work of caring for people, the caregiving work, were still in families, in households, which is still mostly performed worldwide by women, if mm-hmm. it were counted, it would constitute 50% of the reported GDP. And yet GDP completely leaves that out. And economists talk of it as only reproductive rather than productive, which, and so did Marx and so did Smith. So this capitalism and socialism, we have to change what we are taught. That young people are demanding this today, are asking it, but they need to do more than ask. They have to demand.
And they have to flood those areas of work. I mean, that desire to do the caring work, the caregiving work, if they flood those areas, then they demand higher wages and higher esteem for the work. But what you said, you know, kind of going back to that second wave feminism, where there was that moment where women were stepping forward and saying, we want to value, you know, the work. Unfortunately, it seems that they stepped into the domination culture instead of working to esteem the what had been considered women's work. And could we have shifted at that time and missed our opportunity to value the work of caring and raising children or caring for families?
Well, that's the part of feminism that got the most exposure, because there was always a part of feminism. I mean, there are many feminisms. Mm-hmm. And my brand, and I am a feminist, is number one to understand that our language, which takes me to the fourth cornerstone, really, which is not only stories, but language. Mm-hmm. Our narratives, I mean, what are we given as the two gender-specific categories for society, matriarchy or patriarchy? Well, great. What that really tells us is, either mother's rule or father's rule, there is no partnership alternative. And the reality is there was no matriarchy in prehistory, but it was a partnership-oriented culture. That's very different. But like Trump said, you know, it's all about domination. In the domination, properly socialized domination mind, there are only two alternatives. You either dominate or you're dominated. There is no partnership alternative. So we're back to gender, because this male superior, female inferior model of the two forms of humanity, which are the female form and the male form, it's really a template, isn't it, for equating difference, beginning with that fundamental difference in our species, with either superiority or inferiority, dominating or being dominated, being served or serving. And then it's not coincidental that societies with that, you know, whether it's Nazi Germany, you know, is outgroup, in-group versus out-group thinking. So we have racism, you know, difference has to be inferior, right? We have anti-Semitism, which I certainly experienced and barely escaped the Holocaust. We have Shia versus Sunni or Sunni versus Shia. It doesn't really matter. It's always an in-group and an out-group, and not coincidentally, these are all societies that have this model of our species, the male-dominated model. And women as well as men internalize this. So women will call more sensitive, more caring men, less violent men, sissies. Mm-hmm. Now, we have to really understand, because people immediately say, if you talk about gender, they personalize it as women against men or men against women. No, we're talking about really a domination social system. And inherent in that, one of the key components of it is this ranking of male and, quote, masculine, which is, you know, why do men only get anger and contempt, right? A lot of men are asking about that. Why don't I get other feelings? Why can't I be sensitive? I mean, we're talking about human characteristics. Women are saying, hey, why can't I lead? I mean, why can't I? It took us a long time, hundreds of years, really, to even access entry. I mean, want ads were segregated into male into help wanted male and help wanted female, with all the helper, you know, really dead end jobs as help wanted female. So it wasn't the question of the gendered ceiling, the glass ceiling. You couldn't even get in.
Right. You weren't going in the door. Well, and there was
get in. I mean, so this is why, while we have made progress, we really need to focus on these four cornerstones of childhood, gender, economics, move to a caring economics of partnerism. And yes, language and story. I mean, we've been told so many false stories, beginning about the story of human nature. We know from neuroscience that the pleasure centers in our brains, as you know, they light up more when we share and care than when we win and dominate. But our brains are very flexible, especially in our early years. So this is both a good thing and a bad thing, but as we move more towards partnership, it can be more of a good thing.
You're listening to the wisdom of my guest today, Dr. Rian Eisler, author of Chalice in the Blade, thought leader and founder of the Center for Partnership Studies. And I invited Dr. Eisler on today because her work as the founder of the Center of Partnership Studies is coming up everywhere. And if you're paying attention to some of the new platforms and proposals from the current administration, they're talking about better childhood education or child care resources, support for those who are doing the work of caring and caregiving, these values of fluid gender and blowing away this idea of strict, rigid gender roles and changing the narrative. And so, Rian, I want to focus on the economics and the caring economy, because I think that's always, you know, the sticking point that I think people believe we're stuck in devaluing the role of women or the caring economy or the caring work because it doesn't pay. No one's going to pay for that. But you mentioned earlier that if we were to put in our GDP all of the work that goes unrecognized, the free work that caregivers give raising children or taking care of the elderly, because we didn't even talk about that part, but the segments of our population that we hide away, if we lumped that into our GDP, that would increase the GDP by 50%. So you would think that even those that are stuck in a rigid domination capitalistic society, if they could understand the economics the way you've described them, you would shift them over. So I want to cover that. And because we only have like 10 minutes, I want to make sure we cover that. And then the other part, too, is when you talk about partnership, you're not, there's still leaders in partnership relationships. And I think that's important to talk about, too, because, you know, we're not going from a domination to just a free for all, that there's still structure in partnership. So let's start there.
Let's start there, because I always make it a point, and I'm so glad you give us time for it, that there people seem to think very simplistically that if people just cooperated, all would be well. That's not the difference between a partnership and a domination system. I really can't emphasize this enough. Think about it. Cartels cooperate, gangs cooperate, terrorists cooperate, invading armies cooperate. But everything, including cooperation, competition, sexuality, spirituality, economics, families, they're constructed differently depending on the degree of orientation to either end of this domination partnership scale. And what this really goes to is economics, because we have had an economics that rewards the wrong things. It's just that simple. And it really does start with the invisibility of care. The fact that so many men today are questioning this, men are bathing babies, feeding babies, doing, quote, women's work, is a very wonderful sign. The resistance to it, I mean, there's so much I could say about it, but the people who have been socialized in rigid domination cultures or subcultures, they find it very difficult to really respond appropriately to change. And I go into the dynamics of this very, it's convoluted, really. As you know, what happens, for example, is denial. I mean, we see it writ large in terms of climate change denial, election result denial, COVID-19 denial, but it starts very early in the denial that children must somehow make, or most children in domination families must make, because some of them don't, thank goodness, ever, ever. For shelter, for whatever care they get, are also the people who are causing them so much pain, psychologically, physically, what have you. And so these cultures, as I said, are characterized by in-group versus out-group thinking, not only devaluing women and the quote stereotypically feminine, but out-group. So strong man leaders, you know, whether they're religious or secular, help with the deflection and denial of these feelings that children can't really, it would be too painful. And it would be very unrealistic, frankly, because they would die. And I've done a lot of writing on the human rights of women and children. I really urge people to go and look at my articles on the human rights of women and children. But that's as an aside, but a very important one. So they deflect it against the out-group, scapegoating. That is characteristic, as I said, whether it's Shia versus Sunni, whether it's, the racism in the U.S. or anti-Semitism, it doesn't really matter. It's the out-group that we're going to blame. That's the narrative. And it's, again, a false narrative. The system creates artificial scarcity. Domination economics create artificial scarcity, not only by really misdirecting resources to the top, you know, whether it's a Chinese emperor or an Arab sheikh, or it's very ancient with trickle down economics, you know, neoliberalism, so called. What is it? It's the feudalism, isn't it? Those at the bottom are supposed to content themselves with the scraps dropping from the opulent tables of those on top. It's domination economics, not capitalism. Not socialism is the problem. So we have to understand this.
So it seems like, you know, whenever there's this proposal forward, so the idea that we can offer free early childhood education, you know, and support from women or men who stay home and raise children, that there's this scarcity idea that we could never afford it. There would never be money to support these programs. And so therefore those who do the caregiving work, who are always going to do the caregiving work, that I think that's the trap, is that whether or not the people who are caring for children or the sick or the elderly, they're going to have to do that work. That's just a fact of their life. So we can say, oh, there's no money to support these positions. As opposed to, we always seem to have money for military, we always have money for these things. And so that seems to be what's shifting, is that now we're saying, no, not only is there money, here's how we find the money to support this work. And in our last few minutes, it seems like one of the blessings of COVID, of the pandemic, is that it's highlighted the value of those who do the care work, that we need these people as our essential workers, caring for children and the sick and the elderly more so than ever. So it seems like the ripe time to really move forward these corners.
Absolutely. This is the time. And it's also the time because of the dislocations of the shift, and it's very rapid, from the industrial to the post-industrial economy. And we at the center, by the way, are developing new metrics, because we measure what we value and value what we measure. A social wealth economic indicators, and now a social wealth index that shows the financial economic value of caring for people starting at birth and caring for our natural life support systems. We need these metrics. We need your support for developing them. But I think that I believe in human creativity. We can recreate the system, not just put a Band-Aid on it and, you know, try to make it more environmentally sustainable here without paying attention to childhood and to gender and to story and language. We have to change the whole system. And we can do it in bits and pieces. And it's beginning to happen. But we need to have this larger frame and understand that the struggle for our future is not between right, left, religious, secular, Eastern, Western, Northern, Southern, capitalist socialism, but between those of us who really want to move to a partnership system of greater equity, greater accountability. There are trends in this direction, greater gender balance, gender fluidity, and yes, less violence. And those who think, again, that the only alternative is either dominating or being dominated, and then want to retain the old system that they've been taught is inevitable. Once we get this, we can work more effectively together.
I love it. Dr. Rihanna Isler, thank you so much for coming in and sharing your wisdom. People who want to get to know more of Dr. Isler's work, start with The Chalice and the Blade. That will blow up your mind and start to help you see the bars behind which we all seem to operate. Make sure you read Sacred Pleasure and then notice or go into her work with the Center for Partnership Studies. You can find it online. So the Center for Partnership Studies also has access to articles that Dr. Isler has written. Check out her book, Nurturing Our Humanity, How Domination and Partnership Shape Our Brains, Lives, and Future. Be part of the new 21st century political agenda. When you hear it in the State of the Union speeches, you're going to know that Dr. Isler was at the forefront of bringing this to our future. So thank you. And thank you for tuning in to this conversation with the Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. You can send me an email to Elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. Podcast our shows wherever you get your podcasts. Tell your friends to tune in. Support our Central Coast Public Radio. We are still in our pledge drive. So if you like what you hear and you appreciate what we do, please send in your pledge and continue listening and supporting Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.